A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
Man, what's the matter with that cat there?
Must be full of reefer.
Full of reefer?
Yeah, man.
You mean that cat's high?
Sailing.
Sailing?
Sailing lightly.
Did you get away from here? Man, is that the reefer, man?
That's the reefer, man.
I believe he's losing his mind.
I think he's lost his mind.
You go back in time to the 70s and the 80s and the 60s, and if you were to zoom forward to today and see how Californians can cast a ballot on November 8th and actually legalize pot, it's a revolutionary change in the way that we think about how marijuana functions in society, but also how we deal with fact-based understanding of the world around us. And that's a really positive and cool thing.
That's Krishna Andavolu, the host of the Viceland documentary series Weedikit. Ahead of the election on Tuesday, we called Krishna to discuss one of the most eagerly awaited and controversial items on the ballot in California, Prop 64. If the measure passes, it will legalize recreational marijuana and hemp use in the state. So we've devoted this show in its entirety to the herb. Your show's really interesting. You cover so many aspects of the conversation.
Yeah, in a sense, like, what we're doing is sort of chronicling this changing tide, the turning of the page from a illegal subculture to a mainstream legal culture. There are medical stories about how it can help people with certain illnesses and syndromes. There are criminal justice stories about how people are still in prison for it. And there are economic stories about how it, you know, could be the next large, huge industry, a multi-billion dollar industry. And in a sense, like, Prop 64 and the implications that it has on the state of California falls within those sort of three categories as well. And so it's really like a sea change, if you think about it, what's happened over the last decade or longer about what we think of weed, how we approach it, and what it means for our lives as just sort of everyday Americans.
One of the things that I'm most curious about is that if Prop 64 passes, who will be most affected on the growing end of things? Well, you know, the old line hippies who have created these amazing strains and have been struggling for years, are they going to be shut out of this whole thing?
Well, that's the great fear. And that fear has sort of persisted for quite some time. I think even when medical marijuana was legalized in California, the writing was kind of on the wall that eventually this was going to be legal. A lot of growers up in the Emerald Triangle in Northern California have kind of been fearing the oncoming rush of kind of big marijuana. But those fears have sort of been heard in some senses by the people who've kind of drafted what Prop 64 would entail in a regulatory sort of situation. They're trying to address that problem. And so one way of doing that is offering tiered licenses. So licenses for large-scale grows, medium-scale grows, and even small-scale grows. And then for the large-scale grows, for grows that have unlimited acreage, what they're basically doing is saying, you can't get one of those licenses for 5 years after the passage. So in a sense, giving a runway to smaller growers who want to get bigger to do so instead of having, say, a large company come and just buy up all those licenses, buy up all the land and force the small guy out. It's going to be different. And I think one of the biggest things that'll happen undoubtedly is that the price of marijuana will dip. For the longest time, because marijuana was illegal, an artificial scarcity was kind of created. And that's kind of where some of these prices, you know, $2,000 per pound, say, or $1,500 per pound came from. And when those prices drop, it's going to be really hard for small growers to continue their operation. You know, while the regulations are trying to accommodate for those fears, like, the realities of sort of market-based economics might, you know, force the hand of the invisible hand, I guess. It remains to be seen, those fears of small marijuana growers being shut out. But there is always collateral damage sort of when things change. And so that might be one of the things that ends up happening.
Since I work in the food space, I'm always thinking from the consumer point of view and marketing and branding. And I mean, in my head, I say to myself, Are there going to be boutiques that sell artisanal, organic, sustainable pot that comes from, like, your friendly farmer's market? Will it show up in CSA baskets? Will there be pot cafes that are like bars? Will it move into the space kind of like alcohol moves into the space? Or will it be like cigarettes? Will medical marijuana shops, some of them, become smoke shops?
Yeah, I mean, that's also a tough question in a sense. A lot of people I met in Northern California are trying to brand themselves as kind of artisanal, small batch, sun-grown Northern California growers. They're trying to create an appellation, in a sense, make Humboldt County like an appellation that offers some standard of quality. And that kind of like aficionado culture, I think, is already thriving quite well. It's just sort of a marketing and branding exercise. That said, there will be more mass production as well. And that mass production, it depends on the consumer. If consumers bear out that, yes, they want extremely high quality organically grown, not organically because organic is a federal designation, but it can be called clean green, I think, is a certification that they offer up there. So it's the same idea in a sense, but it's up to the consumer. Are there enough people out there who really care about the quality of pot that they smoke or eat or ingest? Or is it a commodity and people will treat it more like a pre-rolled cigarette? Like, you don't really care where it comes from, but you care about the effects. And then as far as like pot cafes and stuff like that, they're already like amazing and beautiful edible products on the market in California. And most of them are pretty small batch and small scale, because the medical marijuana program for so long has been functioning. The barrier to entry into the medical program isn't particularly difficult. You know, you can go to Venice Beach and get a medical marijuana recommendation for back pain. It's not terribly difficult. So that has provoked a thriving and wonderful market of like really great products. Like after Prop 64, if it passes, you can just walk into a store and buy it.
What I'm wondering, though, is about public consumption of it.
Sure.
Like alcohol. Does Proposition 64 allow for a public space like a bar where there are regulations as to age and not overdoing it, where you would be able to go and smoke outside your house?
Well, that's sort of like the Amsterdam coffee shop model, right? Public consumption is not something that has been a huge push for people in the United States. And I think in Prop 64, it does not allow for public consumption. It keeps the question open to some degree. And I think municipalities have a big role to play as far as setting their own regulations. So we could see pot cafes open in some way. Probably not smoking, though, because the idea of smoking itself is kind of increasingly is seen as an unhealthy activity to do in public. But that's not to say that you could have a pastry shop that has delectable delights made from cannabis and you can consume those in the pastry shop. It is sort of like this brave new world of are we going to have social places where people can get together and get stoned and enjoy? But we don't know.
What about the illegal suppliers of the drug? Once it becomes legalized in this way and there are licenses for people to grow, what will that do to cartels? And as a consumer, how would I be assured that what I was growing was being grown here in the United States by somebody with a license and not something that has a trail of blood and bodies?
Sure. Suppressing the black market is always kind of a primary goal of any legalization effort. And oftentimes after the passage of a legal marijuana proposition or law, law enforcement efforts tend to go up in order to try to stamp out the black market so a legal market can function. So, you know, at the current state, something like 80% of all of the pot that is consumed in the United States is grown in California, which means that under the legal medical marijuana Prop 215 and SB 420 stipulations, like there is a lot of illegal activity still happening. So I think an uptick in enforcement is probably to be expected. That said, like the distribution model for legal growers will probably be more like the alcohol distribution model, which is to say they're licensed distributors who are then able to bring pot from the farm to a dispensary or to a shop. And so I think that kind of like seed to sale tracking is something that they do in Colorado quite effectively. And I think it will be implemented in California as well.
So in Colorado, where recreational marijuana use is legal, there are party buses. So people can just hop a ride when they're smoking or high. Assuming that Prop 64 passes, do you picture party buses coming to L.A.?
Yeah. I mean, L.A. is an interesting spot, but I like to think of sort of in in Northern California where you could go on a wine tour, but instead you'd go on a pot tour and you'd visit gorgeous weed farms and you'd have a driver and you could be in the bus. I'm not actually sure of what the regulations will be for consuming within a vehicle, but it's happening in Colorado.
Yeah, because if it's being consumed in smokables, then the driver would be getting stoned along with you unless he was hermetically sealed.
Yeah, maybe there'll be an uptick in plexiglass barriers for driving cockpits.
It's going to be just so interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, there is some trepidation, you know, and I think like even within the grower community, not everyone is for Prop 64. And then in law enforcement community, not a lot of people are for Prop 64. It's not a perfect solution to the problem or the idea of legalizing recreational marijuana, but it's a step forward. And I think we shouldn't downplay the revolutionary step forward it'll actually be, because California is, what, the eighth largest economy in the world? It's a country to its own. And it will function, whether it likes it or not, as a model for the potential nationwide legalization and if other countries are interested in legalizing pot too.
Who is behind the intense boilerplate regulation part of this law as to how it gets rolled out and all of these really tiny granular questions?
Yeah, a few years ago, there was a blue ribbon commission or a panel appointed, headed by Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom, and including stakeholders from all sorts of areas of law enforcement and of growers and patients and everyone they could try to find who might want to weigh in on how they might write these regulations. So they've been working for some time and touring farms and doing the kind of legwork necessary to actually understand what the situation on the ground is. So, yeah, I mean, I think it is, in a sense, Gavin Newsom's pet project. He's been at the forefront of trying to make a functioning and workable regulatory environment for a flourishing recreational marijuana market.
Is there a sense that if California manages to do this correctly, that it will be the lever to really force movement by the federal government?
Yeah, I think that's kind of the subtext behind it all. I don't know if anyone has said, if California, then the U.S., but I think what is potentially down the road is the United States descheduling marijuana from the Controlled Substances Act as a Schedule I dangerous, harmful drug with no medical benefits. They refused to do that earlier this year, but I think it's kind of just a matter of time until that happens. My personal opinion is that a state-by-state model will likely continue for quite some time, but it's the kind of thing like where you just sort of never know. If you look at the progression of marriage rights for LGBT people, that happened very quickly. There was political momentum. It happened through a Supreme Court decision. These things tend to foment, and then a page turns. So it's hard to predict when that would be, but you know, it's not incorrect to say that California's legalization of recreational marijuana will be a momentous occasion and one that everyone's going to be paying attention to.
Krishna Andavolu is host of the Viceland documentary series, Weedakit. Next, we talk to a chef whose not-so-secret ingredient is cannabis. Stay with us.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. So, Jeff, tell me what you had for breakfast.
This morning I had hash browns, eggs, and sausages.
Wow, an actual breakfast.
Yes, an actual, but the hash browns are infused. Yeah, yeah, they really are.
That's Jeff. He doesn't use his last name. Let's just call him the 420 Chef.
Wow.
I call them real hash browns.
Real hash browns.
And they're actually in the cookbook.
Jeff has a whole book of recipes that feature cannabis in them. It's called the 420 Gourmet.
They're medicated with CBD instead of THC. When I first started this, my friend's mother got sick and I was making cakes and cookies and brownies. You know, I mean, that's typically what people did with cannabis. This goes back 5 years, and I was living in New York, but traveling back to LA because I grew up here to visit. Every time I would visit, I would cook for her, you know, and she didn't smoke cannabis at all. She didn't smoke anything in her life, but it was all about the edibles. One day she said, you know, All these things are really great, and they taste delicious, but they're all desserts. Why don't you just figure out how to make something that's not a dessert? And on top of that, maybe take out that taste, because I don't want that taste in everything, you know, that I'm eating. And it took me a long time to figure it out, but I did. You know, first I was learning how to use the oil and the butter in other food items. For example, salads. You know, who would think of putting cannabis in a salad other than putting the leaves in the salad, which, by the way, I do as well. But that's just protein, and they taste delicious. They're kind of like a peppery taste to them. But they're not going to give you that psychoactive feeling if you need that. And yes, you will get medicinal benefits from the leaf because the plants do actually have a lot of really valuable medicinal properties to them. But you really want in your edible to have those cannabinoids pulled out for you, like through the decarbing processing. So I'm like, okay, well, how do I make a salad? Let's make a salad dressing. And it tasted horrible at the beginning. It was terrible. And I'm like, well, let's get rid of the taste. It was a labor of love, really, to come up with taking out that taste. And again, that took me about a year and a half to figure out how to do it. But then one night we had a dinner, and I said, you know, everything here is infused. Tell me what you think. And she was like, oh my God, I think you pretty much done it. I really didn't taste any cannabis in this. And I started working then with using it in my baked goods, et cetera. And one thing led to the next, and I just gave it to someone, a guy named Justin Jones, who interviewed me, unbeknownst to me, for the Daily Beast. You know, he was doing an article on cannabis, and we just had a conversation. I said, by the way, here's my latest cupcake. I think I forget how to take the taste away, but let me know what you think. He said, I'll let you know in the article.
And he called you the Julia Child of weed.
He did, and it was incredible. And it was, to this day, I am so grateful, because that is probably one of the greatest compliments you can give any chef. You know, someone like me I wasn't even a chef. I am self-taught. Yes, I have taught since then many chefs how to do what I do. And in turn, they have taught me how to do what they do. So instead of paying me, they'll be like, you know, let me teach you how to do this. And all of a sudden, now they call me chef. You know, and now I have become a chef that people look to figure out how to cook with cannabis properly. So it's all just been like one amazing journey.
It's a really wonderful, super serious cookbook.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, the first of its kind. Congratulations.
Thank you. One of the really fun things also I want to mention in the cookbook is that every recipe has dosing predetermined for you. So if you're lazy and you don't want to go through the calculations, or you don't want to go to my website and just pull down the calculator and type in your information, you can go to the recipe. And if you follow my method and recipe for making the canna butter and canna oil, and then you use that canna oil or canna butter in the recipe as per the recipe on this little sidebar that says, well, each serving is going to be 2, 3, 5 milligrams, depending on the potency of the cannabis that you're using. So, you know, there are two things that you need to know when you're cooking with cannabis. Number one, what's your starting percentage of THC, which in many places they can already tell you that. So reputable dispensaries will be able to tell you that. But if you don't know, a good rule of thumb is between 15 and 20, I'd say like 18%. But just go through the cookbook and you'll see that there are little cheats that tell you just how many milligrams per serving are in each dose.
So what fascinates me about this is the mixture of science and art.
Right.
Talk a little bit about that.
So the science part is most people don't know, number one, even what strain they get in their edible. And that's very important. Each individual strain will impart a different effect. And the different family of strain will impart different effects. So right now, people call it sativa and indica, and they think that a sativa is going to be more focused and uplifting, and an indica is going to be more relaxed and couch lock, et cetera, which is not necessarily the case. And I talk a little bit about that in the book. But that's right now the common belief. Now we're finding out that sativa and indica really mean just really where the plant comes from and what the plant looks like. So, you know, you'll have a sativa, which is a taller plant with longer leaves, thinner leaves, and then you'll have an indica, which is a shorter plant. It's more bushy, and it's a little more squat, so to speak. So, and you can tell just visually by looking at the plant, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that's the effect that it's going to impart to you. And people are just now learning about that.
And also, there's the science involved in actually titrating a dose, because—
Correct.
We all either have had the experience ourselves or have watched the experience unfold of somebody maybe eating a brownie or a cookie and eating too many.
Correct. And that's a big issue. When you make cannabis-infused edibles, you're like, oh, I'll just make some butter, I'll make some oil, and I'll just put it in my cookies or my brownies, or, you know, in the case of my cookbook, a salad or a meatloaf or, you know, whatever it is. without knowing what the potency of that butter or oil is. Then you serve it and people have not necessarily a very positive experience.
There's one thing I want to ask you about that, because I was surprised. There apparently is a pretty simple fix if you find yourself in one of these situations and you're not having a positive experience.
Yeah, there are actually a couple fixes at this point. There was a Men's Journal posted that ibuprofen, for example, if you're having a negative reaction, if you take 2 ibuprofen, then it will negate the negative effects of the THC, but it will still keep the positive effects. So if you have too much THC, the negative effects are anxiety, paranoia. You know, they're just, it's a very uncomfortable feeling. You feel nauseous. You're like, oh my God, I'm going to die. But if you take 2 ibuprofen, it will negate at least some of those effects.
Without negating the medicinal effects.
Right. And the medicinal effects come from both THC and CBD, which is a compound in cannabis that a lot of people really didn't know about until recently. And that's the non-psychoactive compound. And the cool thing about CBD is if you have CBD and enough CBD in your edible, it will negate the effects of THC as well. So a lot of times what they say is if you're having a negative experience with THC, if you can somehow get a CBD edible or some way to get CBD into your system, which is one of the things that I teach also in the cookbook, then that can also help negate the effect. One other thing that I just want to mention is the time that it takes for cannabis-infused edibles to kick in can lead to a lot of these unwanted effects. Because if you I'm not feeling it, you know, and you're like, you have more and more and more. People don't realize that 2 hours later is when really the effects kick in. So if you're not feeling it and you keep eating it because you want to feel it, you're going to feel it. But it's going to be 2 hours later and you're going to probably have too much if you're not careful.
It kind of fascinates me, the idea that I would sit down or serve friends a meal, because you really would want there to be very, very little in everything you're serving.
Correct.
So that you don't wreck your closest friends.
Right. I call it responsible hosting.
It is.
And responsible hosting comes from responsible dosing. One of the things that people need to understand is that a standard dose, which has been defined by the Colorado Department of Health, is 10 milligrams of THC. When it comes to the two main compounds in cannabis, you've got THC and CBD. You can't have too much CBD. If you do, you might feel a little tired. But you can certainly have too much THC, as we all know. So responsible dosing is keeping your guests within that 10 milligram level, unless you know that your guests are super experienced with cannabis and they're like, oh, I do 50 milligrams, you know, and I medicate on a daily basis, and it's a whole different story. But the majority of the population is fine with 10 milligrams of THC. But how do you get to that point? And how do you even know that you've gotten to that point? So it took me about 18 months to figure it out, but I figured out a formula for my butters and oils that were tested by 3 different labs. And the formula will help you determine just how potent your butter and oil is, which are the base ingredients for cooking with cannabis. And then using that information and the formula in the cookbook, and it's also my website, if there's a calculator that you can use, using that will help you determine how much of your infused butter oil to use in your recipe to make sure that everything that you are giving to your guests and even to yourself is what I call low dose, or it's microdosed. So I teach layered microdosing. So if I'm doing a meal for you, for example, let's say you have a salad that's infused, and then you're going to have your main dish and a side dish that are infused, and then you have your dessert. Well, if your appetizer, for example, is 2 milligrams, you're good to go, right? Then you move into your main course. Let's say your main course is 3 milligrams, and your side dish is 2 milligrams. So now you're already at 7 or 8 milligrams. So then you have to make sure that the dessert is only going to be at 2 or 3 milligrams to keep you in that range.
So what fascinates me about this is looking at your recipes. Some of the recipes have as little as 1 teaspoon.
Correct.
Of butter or oil. So this is definitely a finer and more finely tuned way of looking at cooking with cannabis.
Correct, yeah. And that's something that people are just now finding out, that there's 2 benefits to using less cannabis in your recipes, right? You can eat more of a delicious food and know that you're slowly dosing, and it also will taste better. In the cookbook, there's the my light-tasting canna butter and canna oil recipe, which makes the canna butter and canna oil that you're going to use as your base ingredient much lighter tasting than what you currently get, you know, in edibles that you'll purchase in a dispensary.
And let's talk about how you do that. It's really fascinating. You do go through quite a process to kind of leach out the stronger herbal notes, let's
Correct.
Say. How do you do that?
So I start by soaking it in distilled water. And the first time I do this for people, they're like, oh my God, you're putting your weed in water. That's crazy. But what you do is you basically grind the cannabis, not into a fine grind, because you lose a lot when you grind it fine, but you want a coarse grind. So you have more surface area to remove whatever you need to remove. The distilled water removes the chlorophyll and a lot of the impurities that you don't really want to eat anyway, you know, and you'll find out the first time that you do this that the water that you have been soaking your cannabis in is disgusting. It's either black or it's a dark, like really gross green or a gross yellow color. That's all the stuff you don't want anyway. And if you smell it, you'll be like, oh my God, thank God it's not in there anymore. But you keep doing that for 2 or 3 days until the water is clear. Once the water is clear, you're like, all right, I'm good to go. But the truth is, you're not totally good to go just yet. The next step is blanching it. And I blanch it to get out any remaining impurities, as well as to get it ready for the infusion process by really pulling it into the best form it can be.
And of course, we should say that you're not touching the CBD or the THC because these are fat-soluble, not water-soluble.
Correct, right. THC and CBD are housed in the trichomes, which are these little like glass-like mushroom-type things on the leaf. And those are hydrophobic. They're afraid of water, so they won't go into the water, so they stick to the leaf. So you will lose your potency when you're grinding because your trichomes are falling off, and we call that keef, you know. And then when you do your soaking, you're going to find some keef in the water. But then when you do your blanching, you're getting rid of the rest of the keef that's fallen off. So now all you have left to infuse is the leaf that has all the chlorophyll leached out of it and anything else that you really don't want, pesticides and heavy metals and all this stuff gets taken out through the processing. And then you've just got a leaf with trichomes that you're infusing into your butter or oil. So your butter or oil are going to be clean, but they're also going to be less potent than the cannabis that you started out with.
The last thing you do with it after you have blanched it and wrung it dry is the process of decarbing.
Correct, correct.
So describe what that is.
Cannabis, when it's raw, has THCA and CBDA as their cannabinoid compounds. The A is an acid. As long as that A is attached to the THC or CBD, you're not going to feel anything. You can certainly medicate with them, but you won't feel any psychoactive effects or anything, and they'll be a lot less than if you decarb it. Decarbing is a way to take that A or the acid molecule off. So now you just have the THC, as we know it, and CBD. As we know it, the THC, the psychoactive part, you'll feel. The CBD will be a lot more soluble in your system. So by getting rid of that A molecule, that's why we do decarbing. And decarbing is pretty simple. You just take your cannabis, you put it on a tray. It's all done by heat and time, really. So, you know, when you're smoking it, you're instantly decarbing and it's going into your system and that's where you feel it. But when you're cooking with it, it takes time to decarb. So you're going to put it in the oven, you're going to cover it up with foil so any cannabinoids that are evaporating off of it can settle back in to the plant itself before you infuse it. But the heat and the time, which for me is 240 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 hour in the oven, is the best way to decarb it.
And now we get to put that dried, decarbed plant material into a fat.
Correct.
So we can take out all the stuff.
Correct. The wonderful cannabinoids.
Yeah, the cannabinoids. Do you have a preferred butter and oil that you like to work with?
Absolutely. My preferred butter is Kerrygold or any grass-fed butter. But I say Kerrygold because it is super hard to find any other grass-fed butter here in the United States. It's even harder if you're in Canada because they don't even have grass-fed butter there. But Kerrygold is really the best for me. And it works best for everyone that, you know, that I've taught how to do this. And it tastes great and it's healthy for you. Grass-fed butter is a healthy butter as opposed to the regular butter that you'll find in the supermarket. And it's also been proven to lower your bad cholesterol levels, raise your good cholesterol levels. And there's just a lot of benefits to grass-fed butter. As far as oils are concerned, I love using coconut oil. You can either do the extra virgin that tastes like coconut, which is great for Asian dishes like my hazy Thai wings, which is the number one recipe in the cookbook. Or you can use refined coconut oil that doesn't have, it's not extra virgin, it doesn't have that coconut taste, but it will still give you that coconut oil benefit.
So we've made our butters or our oils, and now you have one more step, which I think is just so smart. For the baking that lets you bake at a much lower dose.
Well, so when baking, everything that you really need to do is cook it at 340 degrees. You don't want to lose any of the cannabinoids. And baking is normally at 350. So you're going to bake down at 340, increase your temperature. It's a much easier way to make sure that you're not burning off your cannabinoids.
And you're also using a different butter. You have diluted the butter with more butter.
When it comes to baking specifically, a lot of people like that butter fat. When you make my light-tasting can of butter, you'll notice on the bottom of the French press, because I always tell people to do it in a French press, it's the best way to make can of butter and can of oil. It's an amazing filter, etc. When you're done making it and you're done with the infusion process, you'll notice that all the milk solids are at the bottom of the French press along with the remaining plant matter that have no more cannabinoids in them. All of your cannabinoids have been put into the oil or the butter.
So you've basically made ghee.
Correct. So you basically make ghee or clarified butter. So that doesn't have those milk solids. And a lot of times when you're baking, you want those milk solids in there. There's two benefits to taking that can of butter that you've just made or the can of ghee that you've just made and now mixing it with regular grass-fed butter. So you're diluting the potency, but you're also adding a lot of taste. But the best part about this is that you can make amazing edibles like fantastic chocolate chip cookies, for example, or my can of apple roses, and you can have two or three or four or five of them knowing that because you did this, each one's only going to be 1 or 2 milligrams per. So for bedtime, before I go to bed sometimes, you know, I have these 2.5 milligram insomnia cookies that I make, and I'll just, you know, do 2 or 3 cookies before I go to bed, a couple hours before, and I sleep like a baby.
Talk to me about the little tower you make with cream puffs.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So we take cream puffs and we stack them up into a beautiful, like, pyramid. You can either adhere them with caramel, which I love to do, and then you drizzle them with chocolate on the top. You can do infused chocolate as well. And you can make a ganache out of it, or you can do, you know, the caramel sauce. But it's a really phenomenal, number one, beautiful looking party tower of cream puffs, just oozing goodness. Delicious.
That's the Julia Child of Weed, Jeff the 420 Chef. His book is The 420 Gourmet, The Elevated Art of Cannabis Cuisine. Find a recipe for his hazy Thai wings on the Good Food blog.
You a hype. What? You a hype. Man, ain't nothing wrong with smoking weed. Weed is from the earth. God put this here for me and you. Take advantage, man. I'm in
love with marriage. What do you reach for when you get the munchies?
You know, I don't get high a whole lot, but when I do, I could take down a whole bag of Milano cookies.
Our munchies montage is coming up in a minute. Don't turn that dial.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. I don't want to make a sweeping generalization here, but I think it's probably fair to say that most of you listening to the show have been high at least once or know someone who has gotten high. We dispatched our producer Joseph Stone to Venice Beach to find out what people reach for when they get the munchies.
When I'm high, what do I like to munch on? I love Butterfingers, bro. Butterfingers are the bomb.
One of my favorite desserts when I'm high would be the Twix ice cream bars.
Cereal, probably a mixture, so like half shreddies, half granola.
Any Mexican food, like El Pastor tacos, carne asada.
Chocolate, anything chocolate. Peanut butter and jelly with bacon. It was so bomb.
I ate cherry poppins. It's a dessert that was invented high. And it's like graham crackers with ice cream and toasted marshmallows and Marciano cherries with like the cherries on top. And depending on how high, we might put more chocolate.
I like soft pretzels. I eat soft pretzels on, you know, you can buy them anywhere. You can buy them at the grocery store, 7-Eleven, pop them in the microwave. So bomb.
See, it depends for me. It depends on my mood at the moment. But, like, I'll sometimes like Cracker Jacks. Or I'll go to, like, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches or just mix whatever's in the fridge. So it really depends on my mood at the time.
You got to work with what you got when you live by yourself. That's what it is.
I don't know. I can't think of anything right now.
Have you ever been to like a movie theater and you put like chocolate, like raisins or M&Ms in the popcorn? I like doing that at home. I think that's pretty good.
I like Flamin' Hot Cheetos. And you know what I like so much about the Flamin' Hot Cheetos? When you're all done, your fingers are red hot.
You have to have like a salty, sweet combination. I got really high the other day and I ate like a whole bag of potato chips and Oreos. And if I'm really sad, I'll get ice cream.
Candy Blunt is
my girlfriend made it. It was Gusher. It was like a fruit roll-up that's like a sheet of candy. Oh. And then she put Gushers in it and then sprinkled some candy powder and rolled it up.
Wow.
It was like a candy boy. We ate it.
Ribs.
Tight.
Ribs. Smothered and barbecued baby back styled ribs.
I made a grilled cheese and I put a pineapple ring on it and it was a pineapple and grilled cheese and it was really good.
I'm trying to think what I eat. Honestly, like I like to get those 24 bags of like kids chips that you normally like a mom puts in like a lunch box. And like sometimes I've been known to knock back at least 20 of the 24 when I'm high.
You know what? I prefer hot Cheetos, you know what I'm saying, with some nacho cheese on the side. Yeah. It really don't matter. Like at the time when you high, you know what I'm saying, anything could really be used as dip, you know. Yeah, yeah. It could be ranch. It could be a cheese. It could be the sour cream. Sour cream and Doritos. Okay. Man. And a bowl of cereal is always adequate, you feel me? So,
we eat brownies. That's all I eat.
Words.
You like to eat words? What kind of words?
Delicious words.
What's a delicious word?
Delicious.
Mushroom pizza.
The kind that get you high.
The kind that gets you high, yeah.
I like some munchies. You know, the spicy kind. UFO ice cream, a couple of those.
Gotta have a chai iced tea. A push pop off the bat. So you gotta have like the little gummy snacks. You need like, you need the big bag of chips, maybe some munchies like my man said, but I don't know about that, but.
Get stoned first, so.
Yeah. I make my own popcorn. I put real butter on it. I put some salt and some pepper, a little bit of garlic, Parmesan cheese. Oh my goodness. You take down a whole bowl.
Uncle Junebug's mac and cheese. We saute grilled onions and garlic, like a lot. So it's dank. It's real dank, you know? And then you put the mac and cheese inside, and you know, that's how we roll when we faded.
Back in the day, we would take the gummy bears when we were eating lunch, put them on the dash of the car so they would get all warm while we ate. And then as soon as we were done eating, we would take the gummy bears and throw them in the ice chest and let them freeze for a few minutes and then eat the gummy bears. It looked like a fruit roll-up pizza.
Just anything that is in the fridge?
Fried chicken, bro. That's the best.
I like fruit roll-ups.
I like ramen.
Pizza. With pepperoni.
Chocolate.
In-N-Out, double-double animal style.
Taco. Ice cream.
Ice cream.
I love Persian ice cream.
I like to eat gummy bears.
Trader Joe's snacks are really good.
Spaghetti or pizza, pineapple pizza.
Fruity Pebbles.
Anything with Nutella is pretty good. Yeah.
French fries.
I like Rice Krispie treats and ice cream.
Everything, basically.
The Munchies montage comes to us from our producer, Joseph Stone. Don't
criticize it. Cotton candy, Girl Scout cookies is a big one. Lemon, Larry, Sunset Sherbet, gelato. There's a lot of food references when you look at just the different varieties of cannabis.
That's Jillian Ferguson. She's the former supervising producer of this show, and she's currently a freelance food writer and radio producer living in Los Angeles. Jillian recently attended a special dinner that featured food paired with, quote, flowers, unquote.
A flower tasting is a really fancy way of saying people were pairing joints with every course.
So what was this dinner?
So the dinner was put on by Flo Khanna, who describes himself as a premium sun-grown cannabis distributor. The way I like to think of it is kind of like what Sunkist does for citrus, you know, where they work with small growers and then they market their product, they distribute their product, they package their product. And so that's what Flo Khanna is doing. They were introducing their growers and their cannabis to the LA community.
Which is what's going to happen if all of this becomes legal, then we're going to all of a sudden see, at least for the first 5 years, all these different small growers jockeying for market position.
Absolutely. And I think right now it's really a marketing game for these people. They are trying to identify themselves as kind of like the craft brewers of the beer marketplace. You know, there's going to be the Budweisers and the Coors of the cannabis industry, and they're trying to say, hey, we're different. We're the little guy. We're growing for quality, not quantity.
I'm curious about how big this dinner was, how many people were there, and who were they?
There were a little under 150 people there, I think about 135. There were city officials, representatives from political and lobbying groups, dispensary owners, investors from Silicon Valley who are really interested in this space, And then journalists, a lot of food journalists.
So Flo Khanna put it on, and they hired a group called Outstanding in the Field, right? And Outstanding in the Field helped with the food-herb pairing, I guess. Tell us who they are.
Outstanding in the Field is an organization that throws dinner parties all over the country. What they do is they host an event, usually at a farm, like Barbara Spencer's farm, Windrose, up in Paso Robles, or the Coleman Family Farm in Carpinteria, and they'll have a local chef come and cook a dinner. So it's very much a farm-to-table experience.
Was the food for the dinner infused? Was it edible?
It was not. When you walk in, there are tray pass joints, the same way that there are tray pass shrimp with passion fruit glaze. Or Chris O was one of the chefs, and he made a flaming hot kimchi fried rice ball to start off the dinner.
So Chris O, tell us where he is the chef.
Panjip, most recently.
I've always wondered about edible dinners because by the time you come onto it, it's like the dinner is halfway over and then all of a sudden you're hitting the head. So this way you can at least somewhat moderate or control your consumption because you feel the effects. It's more like drinking wine.
Exactly. And that's what they're trying to bill it as. Like, it's a wine pairing, basically. It is a flower pairing, a cannabis pairing. The first joint that they handed out was pretty low THC. I think it was something like 9% CBD, 9% THC. It had a very, like, citrusy aroma to it.
So let me get to that. Was there a sommelier, and what do they call themselves?
There wasn't a sommelier for this event. What they did is they actually sent the chefs the strains in advance and had them pair the food with each variety. There was actually a sommelier at the event there as well who paired wines with each course.
As everyone at the dinner was drinking wine, smoking weed, mm-hmm. and eating appetizers, and then the coursed dinner, was there conversations among yourselves about what you tasted, like if you tasted citrus or if you tasted funk?
I think everyone was just really surprised at the experience, the fact that this was even possible, that this was happening. There was more conversation about, could this be the future of any sort of dinner party, whether it's a private dinner party? Are you going to ever see this in restaurants? One of the founders of Flo Khanna named Mikey Steinmetz, he was explaining to us this concept of dry hitting, which is when you take the joint and you inhale on it without lighting it so that you can actually taste all of the flavor notes. And you do definitely get notes of pine, citrus, rosemary, things that you would associate with
dry herbs.
All sorts of herbs.
Yeah. Had you ever heard of dry hitting before?
No, that was new to me. And since I've been looking into this, I've heard a little bit more about it. It also can be called dry pulling. You know, it's the same thing as if you walked into a dispensary and you were to open a jar of cannabis and then inhale. What you're smelling is the terpenes. And terpenes exist on all sorts of organic matter. Like, you can find them in citrus, in pine, in pretty much everything. One of the most common terpenes that you'll find in cannabis is called myrcene. Some people describe it as like balsamic or clove. You'll find it in ripe mangoes, bay leaves, sweet basil. They aren't distinct to cannabis.
Yeah, I mean, to me, a lot of this has the flavor, so to speak, of the perfume industry.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Because it focuses on aromatics.
Yeah. And I should say that terpenes are not psychoactive. They're not illegal. You can buy terpenes on Amazon if you want.
It's the chemical compound that you inhale, which enhances taste, mm-hmm. because so much of taste is aroma.
Exactly. And there's a lot of science right now of people looking into the entourage effect of how terpenes interact with cannabinoids, which are THC, CBD. And people believe that they all work in tandem together. So these different varieties, part of the reasons that they have different effects is because of the terpenes as well as the cannabinoids.
Okay, so I'm sitting somewhere in Los Angeles with a cigarette filled with marijuana, a very beautifully made one, I must say. I'm smelling it. I'm going to attempt to dry hit it. It's interesting. It's very berry. I'm smelling a lot of berries. This one is called Relax Elvis, although Elvis may have already been too relaxed. I would imagine that there was, at a dinner like this, at this period in time, when we're right on the cusp of seeing what could be this enormous sea change in the culture, there is so much giddiness and self-referential fear, or that idea that we can let go of fear.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, I can't imagine any other time that we've been alive where we've experienced anything like this.
I completely agree. And I think part of the draw, especially when you're looking at the culinary industry and whether or not this is ever going to be taken seriously to pair cannabis with dinners. I think it's just novelty at this point in time. And I think people are trying to destigmatize cannabis. And I think that dinner parties is a great way to bring it out into the open for people like a brand like Flocana. They want to normalize cannabis the way that wine or any spirit has been normalized.
So bizarre that we're having this conversation.
It's crazy. I mean, like I said, I don't know how seriously to take it. I was talking to a gentleman named David Downs. This is his first week as the cannabis editor for the San Francisco Chronicle. He was just named their cannabis editor. And I was asking him, you know, like, do you think that this is going to be a real thing? And he said, you know, people have been pairing dinner with cannabis for years. This isn't something
millennia,
new.
Actually.
He kind of like shrugged it off, but at the same time, he made a great comparison and said, you know, food and fashion, they love new trends and it's novel. And this is a great time for people to have fun and experiment with it. There are people, chefs in Los Angeles right now, who are using cannabis in their meals in like non-psychoactive way, too. I mean, at Shibumi right now, they have a hemp course on the menu that is delicious. And people making cold pressed juices out of turmeric and cannabis that are supposed to be like anti-inflammatory power juices.
If people want to attend such a dinner, are there mailing lists for these kind of dinners that people can get on?
This particular dinner, I don't think that they will necessarily repeat. It was very much to introduce a product to a group of people. However, there are other dinners. Mary Magazine, which is a lifestyle magazine for cannabis, they have hosted a few dinners. They're actually more of infused dinners. They hosted one with a woman up in San Francisco who goes by the name of Sue Weed.
The puns that are going to happen are going to be just, I love that, Sue Weed.
Yeah, and they hosted one back in April, I think on 420, with a chef here in Los Angeles who goes by the name of the Herbal Chef. His name is Chris Sage. But like I said, those are infused dinners. There's another gentleman by the name of Holden Jagger who hosts private events under the name Altered Plates, and he does both flower tastings and infused dinners. All of these events are private. Most of them are invite only. You know, you may catch wind of one if you're on a mailing list.
Jillian Ferguson is a freelance writer and producer living in Los Angeles. Next, we hear where growers stand on Prop 64. Stay with us.
Check out KCRW's music blog for song premieres, music news, performances, and KCRW DJ features. You can keep up to date on all of KCRW's music happenings at kcrw.com/musicblog.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. So how would legalizing weed affect farming in California? Craig McNamara, president of the California State Board of Food and Agriculture, is here to tell us more. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Evan. How are you today?
I'm great. Did you get your harvest in?
We did. Our 36th harvest of organic walnuts was a roller coaster, but we got it all in before some recent rain. So thank you for asking.
So let's talk about this thing, because I think about California. We're the largest specialty food state in the country. The economics of our farming business rivals the economies of some countries. Is this going to be a sea change or is this going to be a blip?
Well, let's first of all emphasize what you just said. We are the fourth largest agricultural economy in the world, that California. So that's absolutely huge. That's after the United States. So it's a very significant ag economy that we have going right now. And as we legalize, and I imagine we will pass Prop 64 next week, there will be changes, and cannabis grown for recreational use will be a significant crop. You know, we say that we grow 400 different crops in California, so now we'll be growing 401 legal crops, possibly. I wouldn't call it a sea change, to put it in your vernacular. It will add to the complexity and the diversity of what we do.
So do you see some farmers who are maybe growing carrots or broccoli or some other crop for food, adding cannabis to their portfolio or switching over to make a better economic mix?
I think adding is the word that I hear and see. I started to have meetings on this issue up to 2 years ago. And in those meetings, we're very substantial growers in California, and very what I think we might term conventional growers. So I think you're going to see all stripes of different people, men and women and farmers, adding this to their crop mix. I don't think it will replace anything that a large company is doing, but it will add to it, as you said.
So let's talk about the plant itself and what the ecological impact of it will be at a time when so many of us are concerned with not just sustainable and organic practices, but actually regenerative practices. Is marijuana a high-impact ecological crop?
Well, when you say high-impact ecological crop, I assume you're referring to the resources and how it's been cultivated. And I think it's very well known that many cultivators of the crop have not done it in an ecological fashion. And that is significantly damaging to waterways, streams, resources that we have. So I think that will all change. And that's probably a plus in terms of legalization. One of the questions that I think we might talk about is its water use. And honestly, I don't know the cannabis plant, the marijuana plant, the hemp plant. I can't compare it to another vegetable or crop or ornamental plant. I don't know what its water use will be. I imagine, like so many crops that farmers are growing across California, buried drip irrigation and very conserving types of practices will be used to cultivate it. So I imagine it'll be right there in the mix. When you think about acreage, because I'm a farmer and I think about how many acres. We grow 450 acres of organic walnuts. A large almond grower in the Central Valley would be growing 5,000 acres of almonds. How many acres of cannabis production will we have in the state? I can't answer that. Somebody like Steve D'Angelo from Harborside here in the Bay Area in Northern California probably could. We held a meeting of the State Board of Food and Ag in August. Our meeting was devoted to medical cannabis. And I was impressed, Evan, at how many state agencies are engaged in that. We have the Department of Consumer Affairs, the Department of Food and Agriculture, the Department of Public Health, the California Bureau of Medical Cannabis Regulation, just to name four. So we really are on board. And each organization is taking a piece of the pie in terms of ensuring that it's done properly, it's licensed, it's cultivated correctly, it's tracked and traced. It's pretty amazing what we've got in place already.
Do you think that what you've just described is why so many growers have come out against Prop 64? People who for years have been, you know, kind of like pirates?
I would think yes. There's concern on the part of people whose livelihood has depended upon this and that they feel that they've done this in a both conscientious and a thoughtful manner and an environmentally safe way, I would imagine that they may have some concern. Echoing back to Steve D'Angelo, he has suggested that California will create its own brand that will surpass any brands, whether it's what maybe I grew up knowing about Mish, which was from Michoacan, or maybe a Colorado brand, that once California establishes both its 30,000-foot level brand, as well as local brands from Humboldt or wherever, there should be a significant opportunity for all growers to be successful.
Yeah, there's concern that 5 years isn't enough lead time for the smaller growers that have been doing it for so many decades before large licenses go on the market. Do you foresee, as part of the regulation from the state viewpoint, that keeping a mix of size of farmers will be important?
What an important question. And as you were asking it, I was thinking about my 40 years in agriculture. You know, I'm a first-generation farmer, so I started out very small. As we move forward, whether it's not only with our 401st crop in California, but all crops, we need a mix of all sizes, and we need a mix of all sustainable practices to, in the larger case, feed 50 million Californians, which will be shortly, or 9 or 10 billion people across the globe. I've always been a farmer that embraces diversity, cultural, ethnic, crop, and size. Very important. We need to support smaller size.
So I have a question of the tax. Proposition 64 establishes a cultivation tax of $9.25 an ounce on flowers and $2.75 an ounce on leaves. It's significant. Will some money from the tax stay in the farming sector?
You know, that's a great question, and honestly, I'm not prepared to answer it. I don't know enough about it. I'd be happy to inquire and get back to you on that. That's a far stretch from growing organic walnuts, so I don't really know. Don't know the answer to that.
It's a brave new world.
It's a brave new world. And, you know, as president of the state board, we deal with water and immigration and labor and regulation and research and next generation. And now we got to deal with cannabis.
So let's talk about hemp for a minute. Hemp is this amazing plant that doesn't need a lot of resources, that doesn't need pesticides, and it doesn't need weed clearance. And it has these incredibly deep taproot systems. Do you foresee also a robust hemp business starting in the state?
Well, I think you really framed it beautifully. Hemp is a plant of the past and a plant of the future. There again, I am no expert in either the cultivation or the use of hemp. However, I do know it has incredible capacities, qualities. One thing that we are much more aware of globally is the importance of soil health. Civilizations long ago knew the importance of soil health. We seem to, it got put on the back burner. It's front and center now. So when you talk about a deep taproot, you're talking about a plant that can allow soils to aerate. You can talk about a plant that can create root systems that will allow good humus and tilth, all the things that soil needs, better penetration of water and percolation. So you're looking at a plant that can help build soils as well as all the myriad of uses that can be derived from hemp. To me, it's a no-brainer. I think you can correct me, but I think it's allowed for research purposes, but we're still a long way away from legalizing hemp production. And I think that's a real disservice to our society.
It seems like it could be a perfect rotation crop.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm out here right now planting leguminous plants to fertilize our organic orchards. Those are the seeds that take that 76% of nitrogen that's in our air and take it down into their root systems and their rhizobes and fix it into the soil through microbial activity. That's the sort of stuff we need to sequester carbon, to combat climate change. And I do think that hemp probably is a piece of that puzzle.
So for you, what's the takeaway here, even if Prop 64 doesn't pass next week?
I just think that the fact that you're addressing this important issue as a reality is so important. There's so many mysteries. And as I said, I don't pretend to know them when it comes to marijuana and cannabis production. But I do know that thoughtful people in the state of California are preparing for a future of cannabis production, and it will be a bountiful one. I think Steve D'Angelo said that it's a $150 to $300 billion a year industry in the United States. That's huge. Just as a closing thought, the word that I try to share with everybody in California today is compromise. Without water, and with a world where climate has changed, our water future is much more tenuous than it's ever been. In order to solve it, we have to compromise. And we are one state. We're not north and south. We're not the coastal inland empire and the coastal area. We're one state with a diverse group of people, and we have to come together to solve the really tough question of how will we manage water.
Craig McNamara is the president of the California State Board of Food and Agriculture. That's it for this week's show. You can listen to any of the segments at kcrw.com or on KCRW's mobile app. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team. That's
Abby Fentress Swanson,
Laurel Garcia,
Joseph Stone.
Hey, Abby.
Here's mine.
Camellia Say.
Joel Stein.
And Ronnie Mickelson.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more good food.